My name is X. Yeah, and I'm in tech. Yeah. Good evening, y'all. First of all, I want to say it is so good to be back home. I am a Richmond native. Yada da me. And so a little bit about myself. So my name is XIA. I am a researcher. I am an engineer. I've been in artificial intelligence for the last 13 years. I've been in tech for about 20 overall. I got my start with AI when I was a soldier in Afghanistan with special operations. Can't tell you what I did, but I can tell you I touched AI way back then. I spent time in Microsoft. I ended up doing a lot of stuff with all their favorite three-letter agencies, so building tools that don't exist. And then I went to commercial at Microsoft. I built like these crazy environments that we called ambient intelligence. So combining blockchain, not cryptos, another thing, not the NFTs, but blockchain, AI, and IoT together to fully automate an environment back in like 2017. And I went to Google. When I was at Google, I went to Google Research. And I was a little tired of coding. Might have been the carpal tunnel. Might have just been the screens and me wanting to like be outside again. So I was like, yo, when I go to Google, I got to do some operational stuff. So of course, God wanted me to fail up. So I ended up going onto the ML Fairness team, which is responsible for checking every single algorithm across all of Alphabet, all of Google, all of Waymo, all the other companies that it owns to make sure that they were working well for humanity, to identify when there were issues and to work with the teams to fix them. I got tired of telling other people where their problems were, even though I was a Virgo, right? It's like, you're wrong. But I ended up shifting over and made two research teams of my own. And one of the research teams I created was a skin tone research team, which actually ended up teaching AI how to see black and brown skin tones, and also taught AI how to see folks with albinism, right? Wow. So on each end of the spectrum, marginalized people were incorporated. Now I have my own AI research firm. I work with very large companies, L'Oreal, Mozilla, LG, SAP, a bunch of VC funds helping guide their journey as well. And why do I do what I do? Because my grandmother, I remember when I was in community college at Berkeley City College.
Okay, okay.
And my grandmother, I was like trying to solve everything. It was like the hunger, it was like 08. So it was like the financial aid crisis, hunger, the kids, the BART train cards are demagnetizing with my cell phone. It was like trying to solve everything. And my grandma came and she said to me, she said, baby, when you can see a problem, it's because you have a part of the solution. And that's why I'm here today. Because the only reason I'm in this seat and you're not is because somebody poured into me freely and openly and allowed me to expand my imagination about what's possible. And I hope that tonight we'll all be able to expand your imagination about what's possible with AI so that collectively we can shape this future together.
Yo, that's really beautiful. Let's give it up to everybody on the panel real quick. X, you know, like, it's crazy because, like, every time I'm sitting here thinking, and last night I just be thinking, like, there's so many questions that come with everything that AI is. And when I look at you and how awesome you are, how focused and passionate you are, and it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. But I also, at the same time, like, I work with a lot of different schools, you know? And so, like, I'm confused about how do we educate children in this time when AI is here? Because I feel like American schools, in many ways, no disrespect to anybody, I worked in schools for a long time, they're just kind of archaic and strange, okay? And they're not really doing the job. And so the kids are bored and things are weird. How do we get to find the next young person in Richmond who can be the next you in this society? Like, I don't even know how to inspire someone to be anything because they can just pull it up on ChatGPT. They can do it on Claude. They can, and so it makes me concerned about the future of identity, let alone the creation of art and business. So can you, like, do you, and it, if it's too deep, don't trip, but like,
I'm right
do you
there
have
with
advice?
You. I'm sinking right there with you.
Do you have advice for like parents and or educators on how we can best use AI to inspire and authentically educate young people and reinforce schools? I don't know, because schools are, they got holes leaking everywhere.
So let me think how to frame this answer. So I was an elementary school teacher at Lincoln Elementary in Richmond, which is on 6th and Ohio, which is in the Iron Triangle by the BART station y'all all avoid. It's still avoidable to this day. It's been avoidable since I grew up there. You still don't go to Richmond BART.
Right? For real.
For real, right? And so I grew up, I taught at an elementary school right around the corner from that. And what I see now, and in my own journey, what I've uncovered, because I'm a self-taught developer, I'm a high school dropout, I had a GED, I went to community college for 2 years, went to UC Berkeley and got sent away to Afghanistan and
wow.
Haven't finished college.
Wow.
So all this AI knowledge, everything that I do is self-taught. And the biggest piece of that, oh, so the, wow, I just like to read. So the biggest part of that, right, is it wasn't having the right teachers, right? Mm. Because any environment I can go in, I can learn what I need to learn. But it's because I know how I learn, so I can teach myself anything.
I see.
And that's the future that's coming, where you have to learn how you learn so you can teach yourself anything.
Mm.
Because the jobs of the future are not going to be an individual mapped to one individual skill. Those days of individuals being mapped to one skill are dead. You are going to be an orchestrator of teams of real and synthetic humans to be able to execute a task. So the future of musicians or content creators is what I'm calling a content architect, where you will be an individual that operates an operating system combined with human resources, with AI tasks to execute something. And then that is how you'll build your brand and your audience. So I'll give you two examples, well three. Let's start with Netflix. So Netflix first came out, they were a content distribution platform. And then what did they do? 2012, they dropped a series called House of Cards. It became absolutely phenomenal. So they went from a distributor to a content creator. Mm. So now they own the platform where everyone's watching. That's the first step. And then they start creating their own content for you to watch. And now who makes most of Netflix's content? Netflix,
yeah.
Right? And then now what is Netflix starting to put in its content as of this morning to be able to generate its content? They're using AI to generate their content. So now all of those people who in the early days made deal with Netflix to get on Netflix are now out of business on Netflix because Netflix replicated their business model. You're going to see this with influencers. You're going to see this with musicians. You're already seeing it where Spotify is generating AI bands and promoting them because they own their algorithm, right? And so there's an element where we are dependent on two things right now, which is a specific skill to be a route to enter into society and specific platforms. And what's happening right now is those specific platforms that have algorithms that we all go to, I'm not going to name them, right, are going to start creating their own virtual creators. You telling me that the world's largest video platform that can completely control who blows up on its platform wants to continue to pay human influencers when they can build and own their own that
right.
don't exist?
Right.
Right? And I think we need to get a little bit more real about that and what's coming. And so what that presents is the same opportunity that the digital camera presented. So the first digital camera came out in 1991, but they didn't become household every day until the early 2000s. And when they started to become household, there were two creators that come to mind who thought about what the future of content creation and content distribution looks like because this tool existed. And one of them said, one day, someone's going to want to watch people as they live their lives. And everyone was like, no one wants to watch you be in your room all day, bro. And he made a website called Justin TV that became Twitch.
Deep.
All the way back when it was just digital cameras. There was another guy who said, hey, these cameras, one day everyone's going to want to share their videos somewhere. We should make a site where people can just put their videos. And we call that site YouTube. So in a future where individuals can create the next Star Wars on their phone, which is coming in the next 18 months. What does content creation, what is content distribution, and what does brand building look like? And why are the tool owners the only ones who get to have a say in that? You all are the creators. You all are the ones whose art is out here. Shape that future and don't be reactive to it. Now, what that means for the children and the youth is the world that we're building right now is the one we're going to leave them. So we can't think about educating them for what the future is going to look like if we're handing off the design of that future to people who lucked up and built an app and are now seen as gods in our society. They're not. Mark Zuckerberg does not represent the whole world. Elon Musk does not represent the whole world. Satya Nadella does not represent the whole world. Sundar Pichai does not represent the whole world. So their thoughts on AI are not the only ones that should matter because we're the humans who are going to be affected by and have to live day to day next to these systems while they keep flying over us.
Mm.
So I invite us all to think about that future together and to think about how do you teach these youth to learn how they learn and teach them how to teach themselves anything because that is the future. So I'll stop there. Sorry.
Yo! What? Bars upon bars upon bars over here. Yo, yes. So, Julie, now this is something that's always really been.
I'm passionate about this.
But we all are, right? Like, yeah, it's all, we all circling the wisdom and the passion, right? So, here's where I start to get, like, unfun with it. How do we prevent AI systems from becoming permanent instruments of systemic oppression, particularly when algorithmic discrimination can now operate at an unprecedented scale and speed, right? Potentially locking entire communities out of economic opportunities, healthcare, housing. We're seeing some of this stuff pop off right now. And so, like, how do you find the laws and how do you find the people to connect them when all of this stuff is at stake and it's so nebulous, literally, day by day?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, when the civil rights, like, let's take the Civil Rights Act of 1964, right? That law was created when this country was in the middle of the civil rights movement. A lot of the protections that were in place were around housing, voting rights, economic opportunity.
Right.
But those systems weren't designed to think about machines, right? So there's a gap there that exists right now in the legal system. Now, we've seen some cases that have emerged when, I don't want to say the name of the bank, but there was a bank that had to pay a pretty hefty class action settlement to black and brown communities because they were charging a higher interest for home loans.
Was it Wells Fargo? Because they used to do me wrong.
I'm not saying no names.
I mean, I didn't mean to say that.
Allegedly. So there was a bank. That, you know, based on your zip code, they were making certain assessments as to people's credit worthiness. And that was a machine learning model that was making those determinations on the credit worthiness of people. Now, the reality is, having had an opportunity to work in government, I understand how regulation happens. I also understand how very slow it is, right? The manufacturing agenda I led became law in the Trump administration after I left the White House. Mm. It still became law, I'm grateful, but it took that long to become law. We were no longer in office.
Yeah.
So we understand that regulation moves slow. It will never move at the pace of technology. It just won't. So, you know, I always say, like, the technology train is here, it's moving fast. But how do we make sure communities at the margins get an opportunity to choose their seat and maybe put on a seatbelt for those guardrails to actually design and develop what the law should look like? I will say from a content creation perspective, a lot of government agencies are starting to think about this. I think about the U.S. Copyright Office. They just came out with a rule at the top of the year centered around AI-generated copyrights. Mm. So if someone makes a song and it's completely AI-generated, it's just straight prompts, that cannot be protected, okay? However, there's a fine line between inserting human creativity to the extent that a machine alone could not have created that art, then that can be protected. Now, I haven't seen any examples. This rule just came out at the top of the year. I haven't seen it in implementation. So we're starting to see government answer the call. We're starting to see codes of ethics that have creeped up. I mean, they've been around in the European Union. The EU is typically on the forefront of regulation, of code of ethics, and how AI should be used. My fear is that my fear is that big tech organizations are going to influence government. And having worked in the government for 10 years, nobody from tech ever came to us and said, oh, let's get involved in the Department of Commerce. Let's understand how commerce.
Right, right.
That was something that never happened.
Right.
And now we're seeing the influence be a little too close for comfort. And unfortunately, communities who are at the margins aren't at these tables to help shape what that regulation should look like. So I don't know. You know, we're starting to see government make some changes, but it's happening at a snail's pace.
No, it totally makes sense. It totally makes sense. And thank you for that. Because, this goes back just to the complexities that are ever evolving, right? And we all have different expectations and hopes based on where we are and what we're trying to accomplish. Sean, I wanted to ask you about a nightmare I have, an artistic nightmare.
Let's talk about it.
All right. So, like, I remember the first time I saw the Tupac hologram, and I knew Tupac. So I'm looking at this hologram and I'm watching the crowd go crazy and I'm like, hey man, turn that off, bro. Turn that, right? Because I'm thinking about my homie and, you know, whatever, right? But then I was like, is it wrong if they never saw Tupac that they don't get to see the hologram do the thing, right? But then I was like, but then who owns the hologram? Like, who actually owns the hologram? Like, I'm going to assume the estate. And then so then I'm like, all right, so then if the estate owns it, then they, but then I'm like, well, what if they got him doing Popeyes commercials in like 2 years, right? And I'm like, that's not lit. And then I started looking at how, I remember when some of the first like fake Drake songs came out and other people start, right? And I was like, yo, you could like replicate people like that? And so then I was thinking about a future where like somebody be like, remember when Chuck D did that song with Elvis? And you'd be like, what? Public Enemy and Elvis? But this could happen tomorrow if somebody really feels like it. So how do you feel about artists having control over their legacies? Because what it really feels like is that, you know, when you see those contracts, it'd be like, in perpetuity and any form of the future and da-da-da-da. And then I'm just like, damn, are they going to make my favorite artist pick cotton digitally for 30 years after they've been dead while their family's hella broke? Like, this bothers me because their families are broke right now. So, like, can you talk to me about, like, how do we begin to create authentic protections for those that do create? Because every time we think about, like, Omasha said, it's the democratization of sampling and da-da-da. As soon as we always feel, I remember when I felt like that back in the 80s with hip-hop. Mm-hmm. Then everybody's broke and this guy dies and they got to GoFundMe. But he was platinum. I don't understand this. Can you help me? Or where's your head at in? I'm not even asking for a solution.
I don't know that I can help you, but I can empathize with you. Yeah, I mean, again, this is tale as old as time. These are paradigms. These are models that existed far before AI. Right. You're talking about the Tupac thing. Yeah, it's cool. With the minute you said that, I grew up on the East Coast. I'm thinking about the first posthumous Biggie album, where it was like,
right. Okay,
there were some joints on there, and I was like, I don't know if Biggie would have worked with the Hot Boys. Like, and then they did another album after that where it was really crazy. And it was like, okay, it does begin to feel like it's an abuse of a legacy. So, you know, I do think that what I can say is this. I think I could easily envision a world in which artists, and we've seen some of this now, but I think it will become more and more defined, where artists develop their own LLM. And that is something, like, look, we all love Snoop Dogg. Or some of us might have complicated, you know, feelings about Snoop Dogg recently. But we'll just say that Snoop Dogg is a prolific and well-known celebrity.
Yes.
And figure in the music space.
Who is that? Just kidding. I love you, Snoop. Just kidding.
He spells his name a lot in songs. Yeah. So anyway. So anyway. I can see a world where for him or for other artists, it's like, hey, they're getting older, or maybe they begin to diversify all the things that they're focused on, and they want to be able to work in a way that feels productive. So it's like, you can't be in six places at once. Maybe it is as literal as the Snoop hologram, but maybe it's also something where Snoop begins to train his LLM, where he is in a space where, when he can no longer record, he is still able to oversee his likeness and is able to basically continue to make music in a accelerated fashion. And I think it's an amazing concept if the artist has ownership of that. Mm. And if they're able to pass that on to, you know, their families after they're gone. Now, the deeper question to me is, does that necessarily produce the best art?
Right.
I might contend that it might not. But I think that, as always, and again, touching on some of the things that the people in the last panel spoke about, it really matters what we bring as humans to the table as far as, okay, is this going to be good? Is it going to be interesting? There are some interesting posthumous albums that exist. There are some interesting things where we're able to see how people can take technology and do things that don't feel so, you know, separate from the original spirit of what the artist's intent was. I think that the legislation of that is going to be important, though, because I want to see that if that's something that Snoop wants to do. What I'm not interested in is seeing whatever record label or entity or corporation then owns the rights to him, because I don't want to see him, as you said, digitally picking cotton. Or, you know, that is horrific. And it's this, you know, again, I'm going to keep referencing Will because he's been such a, you know, leading figure in my journey in learning about these things. So many people have asked him in interviews and in events and things we've done, aren't you concerned about your voice? Aren't you concerned about the fact that, you know, they're going to be able to take your likeness and license it and perhaps, you know, abuse it in ways that you would have never intended? And he's like, no, I'm not concerned about that because the music industry has been fucked. This is nothing new. That, like, when you look at, you know, the origins of recorded music, because another thing that we sometimes forget about is that music, if we look at the timeline, is a really long, long timeline. Recorded music is relatively shorter than that.
That's real.
So we had a very interesting period in all of our lifetimes where recorded music basically defined what music was. But if you think about it, the Delta blues players who, you know, their bread and butter and their rinsing of their soul was sitting, you know, outside on the porch playing guitar, and then, you know, somebody rolls up in a Cadillac and they're like, we'd like to record this. And they're like, what does that mean? What are you talking about, record this? It's like, well, we're going to make it so that your song could be heard everywhere. They're like, you mean I'm going to have to travel? Like, you're going to put me on tour? It's like, no, we're going to take the likeness of that. And we saw how that has been completely abused and sort of, none of those artists benefited. You're talking about the GoFundMe. So it's going to be very important that we figure out ways to protect the artists who are in control, and to sort of echo what Julie said to cap it off, I don't know how that is going to manifest. But it is important that we have these conversations now, because we can't just kind of just go along for the ride and be like, okay, it's cool, I'm sure they'll figure it out. It's like, no, we've already seen what happens when we let those people figure it out. It's not good. It's not good for art.
Yeah.
I want to share one example. It's not necessarily artificial intelligence, but it's economic opportunity. Do y'all remember during the pandemic when, like, all these dances were going viral? Let's just take, like, Meg Thee Stallion and Beyonce Savage, right? There was a dance made to it. Everybody was doing the dances. Well, there were all these, like, black and brown and Asian creators who were making dances on TikTok.
Yeah.
Original content.
And the gamings were picking them up, right?
And people were picking them up. You know, maybe people from a majority group making more money on social media than the actual
originators.
Exactly. So Logitech did something, Logitech for Creators, maybe about 3 years ago. They did, they found all of these creators whose choreography was taken and commoditized without any attribution. And they copywrote their labanotations, the actual choreography,
right,
and they protected it for them.
Wow.
And I think this worries me too, Sean. I mean, this notion of, I think if Will licenses and Snoop licenses his music, his likeness, absolutely. But what happens when you're, like, the words you're speaking on a panel, or the art that you create, or the idea that you come up with is commoditized without attribution.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that is happening right now with technology.
Yeah.
It just is. And I'm not anti, I'm pro tech. Two things can be true, right?
And that's deep and real.
Two things can be true.
Super real.
We can democratize technology and democratize access, really, is what we're talking about. Because there were people working on machine learning 15, 20, 30 years ago. It was the 1% of the 1% who had access to it. We can unlock and enable creativity, but we've also got to protect communities and creators at the same time. Both have to happen.
Yeah, that's real.
So I want to add on to the policy convo. On the policy side, there are three levels of policy, because this is what I do at UC Berkeley. So I dropped out, but I'm back there, and I have a Berkeley email, so hit me up, right?
Welcome back.
this is a wild story. David was supposed to be here tonight. I wonder where he's at. But on the policy side, there are three levels of policy. There's city, state, county, and federal, right? So, like, that's kind of how it goes. The first AI laws were at a city level. City of Berkeley banned facial recognition in police body cams because it didn't work. They could not tell black and brown people apart, which is part of the reason I started my research team. So in that city, those people in that city said, our police department cannot use this specific technology. They didn't take it as some large existential crisis to try to figure out the best way the entire AI system needs to be built. It's for this specific use case, this specific behavior is not allowed. And that's how we write all laws. When the light is red, you are not allowed to go through it or you will get a ticket. When it's during these hours, you're not allowed to drive in that diamond lane or I'm gonna pull you over and charge you $500, right? Those are the rules. They're around specific sets of conditions. And to Sean's point earlier, it's not the technology inherently that's bad. Artists may argue that because of certain types of models that have been trained on bad data. But the technology in and of itself is not inherently bad. It's the use case that's bad. So we regulate the use case. Now, how many of you guys heard last year about that big AI bill that got kicked back in California? It was like national news. They were like, oh, Governor Newsom vetoed the AI bill, right? What they didn't tell you is that was one of 18 AI laws, and the other 17 passed. So the idea that someone can take your likeness posthumously after you're dead and use it is literally illegal in the state of California as of August of last year. The idea that I can take a picture of you off of your social media, run it through AI to make nudes, and put it online is not only criminally illegal, it's also, they made a requirement that the social media platforms have to have the ability for you to report when someone's done that with your pictures, your photos, or your videos, when they've taken your likeness, right? So again, these solutions are not geniuses. It's individual parents saying, if a little boy in my daughter's class takes a picture of her and makes a nude of it and passes around, he should go to jail. That's what I think is right. And they passed a law to reflect that. So I want to take it down a notch from this like idea that you have to like become an AI expert and figure out this technology and know machine learning, deep learning, generative AI, wait, right? Like instead of going there, just to take it as simple as if an AI has the ability to make things up, which means hallucinate, is it right that police departments are using those types of technologies to write police reports automatically?
You know what I'm saying?
Because they're doing it all over the country right now. If large language models, ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini, Anthropic, are always prone to hallucinating and making things up because they're word calculators. They don't actually understand language. They're just advanced calculators. It's like going up to a calculator typing 8008 and being like, it's a sign, I need to get a boob job. It's the equivalent of going to like ChatGPT for life advice, right? And so these systems, because they don't understand language, they may always calculate things that don't make sense. We call those hallucinations or confabulations if you're like in the technical world. And so if they're always at risk and we can never eliminate that from them because it's a byproduct of how the technology works, do you want that technology being used to record the conversation between you and your doctor? You can go look this up right now. OpenAI has a tool called Whisper. It's a transcription tool. Your favorite health department that runs all up and down this state, I'm not going to say their name, uses it, and it hallucinates and makes stuff up that you didn't say and your doctor didn't say, and they don't care because you don't care. AI is being used in 14 different states to determine if a child is at risk in their home and needs to be separated from their parent.
Frightening.
Right? These are very real use cases, and this goes all the way back to like 2014 when they had a state of Illinois did a trial with it. It didn't work. They kicked it off, but 14 other states still use it, right? So I think for us, this conversation around policy is to take it out of that really large, big language, that those large language model terms they throw in our face to make us feel intimidated, and just bring it back to you as a human. In your city, do you want AI surveilling you when you're on the bus? Do you want the buses to have cameras in them to automatically take pictures of your license plate and send you a ticket if you're parked wrong? If you don't, then make that a city law. It doesn't have to be Trump agrees with you.
Yeah.
It can just be your city council people do.
Yeah.
So this future we want to move towards, we can all shape it if we stop making it more complicated than it is and bring it back down to the humanity the same way our ancestors have done. So those who will call us ancestors live in a reality that they can take forward instead of one that they have to undo because we did nothing.
Ooh, bars. Okay, so we're going to shut it down. Give a round of applause to everybody on the panel, and God bless you, and thank you for coming out. You know how we do it one time, Westside.
Hold on.